Welcome to Cybersecurity Insights, the podcast for the cybered.io learning community. Our goal is to bring cybersecurity practitioners the latest and most relevant education and training to upskill and dive deeper into topics that matter in today's modern cybersecurity world.
Good day, everyone. This is Steve King. I'm the managing director here at cybered.io, and today's guest on our podcast episode is Netography CEO Martin Resch, who's going to chat with us about the new addition to the NIST framework of governance. And Martin's a repeat visitor on our show, and you can see an earlier interview we did back on a few months ago. Martin's a very well-known guy in the space, has had some remarkable accomplishments and exits, and is now running this company called Netography, which is also very cool. So welcome, Martin. I'm glad you could join us.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be back. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, thank you. So let's talk about that, the NIST framework and the addition of governance or govern or whatever they're calling it, and how that presents both an opportunity and impacts the community at large here when thinking about and architecting and developing strategies for cybersecurity defense.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. So governance is the latest addition to the NIST cybersecurity framework, and it's interesting that they are finally calling it out. I've always looked at the cybersecurity framework. It's kind of very familiar ground for me because it echoes a lot of the thinking that I have had since the early days, you know, kind of late 90s, early 2000s, of when I was really getting going in security and started to interact with people back in the old days of my first startup. And I started to realize that, you know, there wasn't really a basis for kind of a framework that people had to hang their understanding of cybersecurity off of in many cases. So I came up with my own framework, which is like a three-bucket framework. The NIST framework was a five-bucket framework, but it was very, very similar to, you know, considering what I had to do before an attacker showed up, during an attack, after you were compromised, and the cleanup cycle, and kind of configuring your environment properly and things like that. But one of the things that it didn't talk about, and this is kind of interesting, is governance. And, you know, in the old days, I never really thought about it because I was always so focused on threat-based detection and response and being able to, you know, see these attackers coming, things like that. And I didn't really worry about kind of the considered to be somewhat mundane, I would suppose, process of having good governance. But, you know, good governance is the root of having good security. So it's really interesting that they called it out in the NIST framework now, because it's now a top line item of, hey, you actually have to pay attention to like what's going on in your environment and make sure things stay on the rails so you can, you know, maintain your security posture. So it's great that they called it out, and it kind of signals and sort of aligns with some of my own thinking on the topic as well.
Yeah, and I guess that's accurate enough. Heritage is in kind of a, you know, I don't know, boring compliance centric, you know, zeitgeist around GRC and so forth. And, you know, I don't know that Gartner has has been instrumental in helping or disabling that, any progress in that space, but it's got, you know, compared to threat, it always sort of pales in terms of what people think about and want to pay attention to. But it's obviously super important, and I don't know why it's taken them this long either.
Well, it's funny, you know, when people don't have governance top of mind, then it kind of slips by the wayside. You don't think about it. In a lot of ways, it's funny. It got back on my radar in the Netography days, working with customers and starting to, you know, see the things that we can see with our platform of, you know, being able to recognize things that are going on in the environment that are hard to pick up kind of in the traditional ways. You know, we do vulnerability management or CSPM in the cloud, and we do intrusion detection prevention, or now NDR and GFW and stuff like that. But those approaches are so focused on sussing out kind of, you know, in the kind of vulnerability management CSPM world of, you know, here's how you are configured, here's how you should be configured, and giving you kind of this static view, this snapshot at a moment in time. And then you have the NDRs and IPSs and NGFWs that are very focused on kind of, are there threats present? What are they doing? Have I been compromised? Am I, you know, enforcing my basic policies on network utilization? But there's all sorts of stuff that can be happening that nothing is keeping track of. We started to see things like, you know, going into proof of values. You know, this is like where we do a pilot deployment of our technology and a customer. And, it, you know, we start doing the review at the end of the POV. And it's like, well, you know, your Bitcoin mining is going on over here. And people are like, what? Bitcoin mining? What's that doing? You know, it's a hygiene item. I shouldn't have Bitcoin mining, but what do you have that's actually going to find it? And, you know, the guys who were doing it knew the answer to that was probably nothing.
Yeah.
Same thing with like, you know, dev talking to prod and cloud apps and things like that, where you have, you know, CSPM will tell you, hey, you're configured so dev and prod are talking to each other, you should fix that. And then you fix it. And, you know, push comes out of staging back into prod, and all of a sudden dev and prod are talking to each other again. And, you know, they don't have any real-time mechanism for seeing it. We can see it. We do see it. But, you know, it's all hygiene. And that, when we put it into our fancy security words, that's governance. maintain your basic hygiene so you can have a defendable network.
Yeah. And you've been in this space a long time, Martin. I know that, from your point of view, have you ever seen this level of complexity in the past?
No, not really. Not as pervasively. Like, it's everywhere now. We see it so much that we coined a term for it. We call it atomized networks, right? Where these enterprise networks are scattered across multi-cloud plus on-prem. And it's kind of a result of the pandemic and everybody getting sent home and working from home, being told, you know, hey, just get your job done. So all of a sudden we have all this infrastructure that's kind of poorly understood and was poorly, you know, governed when it was being deployed, because people just had to get their work done and they were working in kind of extreme circumstances. And now I think a lot of enterprises are trying to get their hands around what happened and what have I got, what is it doing and what's happening to it on a day-to-day basis, and trying to understand that comprehensively and being able to kind of get a day-to-day understanding of it is pretty difficult with the architectures for doing security and governance that we've been using for the last, you know, 20 to 25 years.
Yeah. And then, you know, anytime you've got a no holds barred kind of a movement where, you know, you don't have much choice about having to accommodate a, you know, work from home scenario, then, you know, really bad things happen, right? And, you know, because people say, well, you know, I can't do it all. If I'm going to provide this, we're going to have to take on some risk. Well, I think that's the slippery slope we all slid down here over the last 3 or 4 years. And so, but, you know, I mean, there's so many tools and there's so many APIs and there's so many applications per server that, you know, it's so hard for me to imagine trying to exactly do what we're talking about. And that's govern in that kind of an environment. Wait, and then, you know, we have severe resource constraints. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, how do we do this?
Well, I mean, you know, you have to have, for me, and maybe this is an artifact of my time at Cisco, but I start to think about it very architecturally, which is, and when I say architecturally, I mean, what do you have that can, or what can be done that can give us kind of a broad ability to understand the composition of our environments, the activities of the participants within them, both at a coarse grain level of just fundamentally, like, have I got Bitcoin mining going on? Have I got, you know, people running gaming servers? Have I got, you know, all sorts of random apps that are running that nobody knows about? So, you know, at a coarse level, then getting more and more fine-grained as you start honing in on what you've got, being able to start like looking at the trust boundaries in your organization and whether they're being adhered to or circumvented, being able to see configuration drift happening in real time and things like that. You kind of, you know, our opinion, this won't surprise you coming from me, our opinion is that, you know, you actually need a different architecture to go after this. And this harks in all the way back to, you know, well before my time in Netography, just starting to think about when we have these mixed cloud and on-prem environments that are heavily encrypted and stuff like that, how would you even go about this? And you need a different approach to doing it.
Yeah, no kidding. I, you know, Talk to me about what you see in zero trust implementation, for example. I mean, what's the reality versus the chatter?
Yeah, well, you know, the promise of zero trust is like blast containment. This goes way back. Like, you know, once upon a time, on the kind of security researcher and big thinker world, people talked about, well, it's, you know, you shouldn't try to enumerate bad, right? That's what antivirus systems do. That's what intrusion detection prevention systems, and by extension, NDRs and NGFWs do. They try to enumerate bad. And I used to respond, you know, maybe we shouldn't try to enumerate bad, but let me tell you, it's paying the bills right now. And it was true. Like, we needed something. Like, you could try to come up with software architectures that couldn't be compromised. You could try to have, you know, really ironclad GRC and stuff like that. But the reality was that, you know, everything that you did, no matter how hard you tried, you're still going to get things like Log4j bubbling up from time to time, and you needed capabilities against them. So, you know, now we're in this world where we've gone about enumerating bad. And the problem is that it still works okay in many cases, although EDR kind of changed the game on the anti-malware side. And, you know, we did things like, you know, build zero trust on the network side to try to manage the impact of potential attacks. But the interesting thing about zero trust is that in many ways, you know, what it's really doing is it's centralizing trust and basically saying, we're going to trust the identity and access management system to never be wrong. And if it is wrong, the tools that we've traditionally used to see that, you know, there's a problem here are effectively in many cases blinded because like on the network, for example, things are very heavily encrypted now. So the traditional deep packet inspection methods that we would have used on-prem network don't really work. And they're not even available in the cloud networking environments where we have to resort to doing log analysis, running sidecars or agents and things like that. But, you know, the reason we build network-based defenses in the first place is because of the scalability of them. So being able to bring back an architecture that can really be a backstop to your identity and access management system when it gets things wrong, and it will, having something that can be monitoring what's going on, like I said earlier, looking at the trust boundaries and looking at the activities of the participants in the environment and saying, hey, this thing's really gone off the rails, or, you know, this vending machine's doing things that it's never done before on our network. And that's, you know, that's very troubling. And then, you know, really identifying, hey, we've got a compromise in progress here and we need to get our hands around it. And not doing it the old way where we would look for, you know, very discrete attacks and very discrete things, but looking at it this new way where we're monitoring kind of the integrity and activities in the environment and looking for variations on them.
Yeah. So if I look at the zero trust, you know, adoption cycle, if you will, it feels to me like there, after all of the initial reluctance, it took a couple of years maybe, and then people sort of came around and said, okay, we get it. We're going to move to zero trust. And that's reflected in all the stats that you see, right? That, you know, in surveys and so forth, that, you know, 86% of our surveyed CISOs claim they have an initiative to move to zero trust by 2025 or whatever the hell that means, right? And but only like 6% have begun that implementation. Do you think that CISOs are actually afraid to make that kind of a commitment or make that kind of a move, given their lack of understanding of what is in place today?
I think it's a factor that weighs into it, certainly. You know, if I don't know what I've got, then it gets really challenging to decide, you know, how I should configure things so that I can implement a zero trust system, for example, or what the you know, whether it's even possible to bring the things that I've got into zero trust architecture that I'm trying to deploy. So yeah, it's a it can be really problematic. And, you know, with the whole notion of blast containment and having to have everything as much as possible participate in these identity access management infrastructures and access management regimes is, you know, you really do have to have your hands around everything because, you know, if you get a foothold one place that people don't know about and get a set of credentials and leverage them, you know, the whole game for attackers these days in zero trust environments is, you know, leveraging the credentials you get access to escalate privileges and then move kind of at will throughout the...
Yeah, anywhere you want.
Yep. Right, with very low observability because we've merely been blinding all of our traditional security tools to implement it. And in many cases, you know, switching to new security architectures, but, you know, that that certainly aren't comprehensive like we used to be able to do at the network level.
Yeah, and which maybe brings us to generative AI, which we may as well. Last time that you and I talked, ChatGPT either hadn't been announced yet or was just released or something and hadn't gone through that amazingly rapid, you know, beta cycle that it just went through. What's, I mean, in your estimation, what's the impact of that going to be on the sort of, on the standard network and cybersecurity defense environments?
Well, that's going to be fascinating in a lot of ways. I mean, on the attacker side, attackers are obviously going to leverage it. I think phishing is about to get a lot more fearsome as a result of it, but that's not really my my realm for the most part, until somebody gets compromised and goes off the rails. But I think the practical effects in security technologies, you know, we're working on stuff like building using large language models as a bridge into our products. So, you know, we have a custom language called Intography Query Language that's built into our product. And, you know, you have to get into it if you want to really be a power user of the product. But, you know, we're working on a bridge right now, so you can just talk to it and it'll convert what you say into NQL, the Intography Query Language. And we're also working on mechanisms to look through our event sets and summarize events for you. And, you know, when you click on an event, it'll give you an English explanation of exactly what's going on and what it means and how much you should care for your environment. So that's super cool, right? You used to have to be a real gearhead to really understand what these systems were telling you. But these things are getting us to the point now where, you know, you can I wouldn't necessarily say easily, but where it's very possible to have the system explain to you what's going on and, you know, in real human terms and even compare and contrast it to what's happened yesterday. So we saw this attack or we saw, you know, this many of this attack and it's a 47-fold increase of what it was a week ago. And by the way, as a result, correlated with that, correlation does not imply causation, but correlated with that, you've had, you know, a commensurate increase in outbound traffic to, you know, some ITAR country or something like that. Like having the AIs kind of put the puzzle pieces together for you, I think could be really powerful. And, you know, we're certainly delving down that path to a degree with our approach.
Yeah, and the upside is fantastic. The downside, however, is very frightening, right? I mean, you got people today, that have not made a policy decision or have not implemented a policy within their companies about the use of ChatGPT, for example. And every time that, you know, somebody does, they're creating their own sort of shadow IT risk center and sending data out into this, you know, very public large language model that may or may not contain customer information or what have you, right? I mean, so not only is it, you know, the risk of both ingress and egress poisoning, but it's also huge privacy liability as well. And you know, I'm just amazed at how our government officials act as if this is all safe stuff and it's no big deal. And one of the congressmen, I saw one of the congressmen make a comment that, you know, it's not a real danger here. So I let my staff just kind of do whatever they want with ChatGPT. I almost fell out of my chair.
Yeah. Yeah. I disagree with that congressman. Jeez. I mean, yeah, so we use the commercial grade stuff, you know, we're in AWS and things like that. So we're using like the commercial grade tools, so it's not out to public, ChatGPT and stuff like that. But it's a big problem, right? If you try to ban it, people are probably going to use it anyway. And it gets to be, there's all sorts of problems with data leakage and exfiltration and things like that. And also, attackers are going to figure out how to use these tools very capably. And just the downside risk of a lot of this stuff is pretty high. And, you know, obviously there's not a lot of understanding. There is a strong threat of, you know, we've got to figure this stuff out before our kind of geopolitical adversaries do, which is, you know, I think not wrong, but I think, you know, just blithely saying, no, it's all good, we should just use it freely and not worry about it is probably not the play either. Yeah, I hate to be the cranky security guy, but there's a cranky security guy in me always that's like, do you really want to hook this up to the internet? And it doesn't get any better when it's let's send all this data to this AI.
I think we need more cranky security guys. I don't know what happened to them all. When I was Dr. No, but recently it feels like, we've all turned into, sure, it's okay, whatever. Those are problems we're not going to solve, and that netography doesn't try to solve either. But to remind our audience of, back to netography, what the major benefit to a company that uses your technology solution?
So netography is a network defense platform, and what that is a cloud native network analytics platform that can tell you what you've got, what it's doing, what's happening to it across multi-cloud and on-prem without having to deploy anything to make it work. So we can tell you about compromises, we can enable threat hunting, we can enable governance, which is obviously the topic here, by letting you see kind of operationally what's going on minute to minute. So we can see things like configuration drift happening as they happen. And, getting back to the problem, the post-pandemic problem of your atomized network, you map out your network, let you know what you've got, what it's doing, what's happening to it, and do so continuously in real time with an architecture that is scalable because we don't have to deploy anything to make it work. And we operate a cloud scale in our back end. So it's if you want to understand what you've got, if you want to understand configuration drift, if you want to see compromise happening as it happens, if you want to be able to dig into it, that's what we're there for. So from the governance topic of that we're talking about today, seeing things that you will see no other way because you have no way to look for them, and seeing them at scale across your entire enterprise, which is scattered across all these different cloud companies as well as your legacy on-prem infrastructure, that's what we can do.
Yeah, and why would anybody not want that kind of observability, if you will? Yeah, what kind of pushback do you guys get? I mean, why would anybody say no to this?
Well, when we do get pushback, so the other piece of it is we can actually control as well. So we don't just see things. We have the ability to reach out and touch them or work with your security infrastructure or whatever. But, you have a lot of people that are on legacy architectures that are hard to get out from under to some degree. So whether that be the legacy network monitoring tools like a StealthWatch or a Plixer or even stuff like the old IDSs and IPSs like I used to work on, NDR, those are all kind of architecturally obsolete. They have their applications kind of from a point standpoint where I've got a very high value asset that I need to defend in a very particular way, but they have really poor TCO metrics relative to something like us. And I think we're still showing people and convincing them of it. And then they've got cloud monitoring tools that are looking at their kind of what's going on in their cloud network environments that are almost all data lakes where they're just dumping data into a data lake and doing reporting and dashboards. We see things happen in real time. We are very unique in that we are a real-time engine operating at the scale that we're operating across, all the stuff. So when people say no, it's usually because either they've got an investment that they're not ready to part with yet, but I think the writing's on the wall for kind of the old school way of doing things, or they, they're just not operationally prepared to take on a new tool. And of course, there's all the budget scrutiny that's going on right now. And I think one of the things that we're really getting ramped up for now is to really show people the total cost of ownership, TCO advantages that we have with this approach relative to the old architectures that don't scale, that are very narrowly focused, and that really are not well suited to the world that we're in now.
Yeah, budget should never be a reason to preclude advancing our position here against the inbound threat, particularly in light of generative AI, and the bad guys will and are already, leveraging the heck out of that. And as you had indicated earlier, phishing attacks the old phishing attack will become suddenly really elegant and amazing and nobody would be able to tell the difference. And that's true for video and voice as well. And, you know, so and instead of, you know, worrying about spending $10 million here or not, how about worrying about whether your company's still going to be in business, you know, 6 months from now? But
yeah, well, there's always, you know, that's the, that sounds like the cranky security guy. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Well,
I feel the same way. I think, the burden's on us to show that this is a superior architecture. We believe it is. I mean, you've got a lot of extremely experienced people who've built a lot of very real and broadly used technologies who believe this is the way forward. I think to some degree, it's such a departure from what's come before that I think people need to soak in a little bit. We do have some very enthusiastic customers who are like very forward-leaning FICOs and Mercury Bank and so forth, the guys that we can talk about and some other very large enterprises that have very sharp teams that really love this technology and embrace it and are running with it. So you've always got the kind of the early adopters and, you know, the broad acceptance that's on us to drive it. But I think, you know, this trend is inevitable, and there's companies out there in this kind of network defense platform world that's emerging right now, like us or, you know, a Synamics or a Lumu or even a Stellar Cyber or a Mixed Mode that are kind of on the same path and see the same kind of shortcomings of the old world and the opportunity in the new world, that are all kind of young companies that are just carving out this new space.
Yeah, well, I wish you all the best, and I wish that more companies would jump on the opportunity here. So thank you again, Martin, for spending some time with us, and hopefully we can do it again in a few months as this world progresses to I can be less of a negative outlook on this stuff, but it's getting harder every day as you know. So folks, this is Martin Resch, CEO of Netography, founder, and I was going to suggest that, you know, I wish that Cisco would buy this one from you, but you're probably having been down that path once before, you might not be too excited about that. But this needs to get really, really broad exposure very quickly, because it's the only way that I know of that we can actually mount a reasonable defense against what's about to come. So thanks for taking the time, Martin. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it. It was great talking to you again.
Good. Thank you. And thanks to our audience for spending another half hour or so with us. I hope it was informative and interesting to you as well. And until next time, this is Steve King, your host, signing off.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cybersecurity Insights. You can connect with us on LinkedIn or Facebook, or send us an email at social@cybered.io. For more information about the podcast, visit cybered.io/podcast. Until next week, stay safe and secure, and we'll see you on the next episode of Cybersecurity Insights.